Welcome to Saving the Game.
This is episode 7, Dark Settings, recorded Thursday, September 13th of 2012, with your hosts, Grant, Peter, and Brandon. Hey listeners, this is Grant. Our apologies for the long delay in getting new episodes out. As you're about to hear, my life had a pretty major shakeup, and Brandon's class schedule has been intense, so editing time has been scarce until very recently. But we are back. I want to take a moment real quick to tell you about our Christmas charity drive. This year we're raising money for PEG Partners, a small grassroots charity founded by one of my favorite musicians, David Lamott. PEG Partners focuses on targeted and effective improvements to Guatemalan schools in areas where they're severely lacking, things like running water and kitchens and other things like that that we take for granted. More information about the charity and about our fundraising drive is available on our website, savingthegamepodcast.org, so come on over and help us help them out.
Good evening and welcome to Saving the Game. I'm Peter.
I'm Grant.
And I'm Brandon.
Yep, we've got Grant back this week, guys, and he's got a bit of a story.
Yeah. Those of you who listen to the show fairly regularly may have heard that I'm just had a daughter. That only took about a month. Surprisingly complicated. Or the day after we recorded episode 5, we were going into the hospital to get my wife induced. That took 4 days, involved 22 hours of labor at the end of it, an emergency C-section, which was followed by a collapsing ceiling right outside of our room in the hospital. And then we discovered our daughter had heart problems, shipped her to the local NICU, which is the neonatal intensive care unit. And then she went down to Charleston, South Carolina, and MUSC for heart surgery at about 9 days old. So it's been a complicated month. Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah, that sounds pretty heavy.
Yeah, I think the word I would use is brutal.
Yeah, it's not been a fun month. But, first of all, she's doing great. Everybody's recovering. We're back home. All is well. Rachel's going to need to see the cardiologist fairly regularly just to make sure that everything continues to be okay. There's a few remaining problems, but her surgery went very well. And, you know, it tells you something about the state of modern medicine when, you know, heart surgery on a 9-day-old infant is described as routine. So,
yeah.
And it, fortunately, it wasn't open-heart surgery. It was a repair to the aorta, which they could kind of do by going in between some ribs on the left side. But still not fun. Fortunately,
still pretty incredible, too.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's really quite impressive what they are able to do. Fortunately, we've got a friend who's from Charleston, and his parents, who are very generous people, put us up for several days at their house and then at their beach house, so we had a place to stay for a while until Rachel was out of the ICU down there, at which point we moved into her hospital room, which was a lot of fun because there was a recliner for two people to sleep on. We ended up just sort of sleeping in shifts. Yeah. But, yeah, so that's where I've been for the past month. I apologize, folks. I've been taking care of that.
There's nothing to apologize for. I think I can speak for both myself and Brandon, as well as all of our listeners, when I say that I'm just glad you're okay and your family is okay now.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Yeah, he said exactly. I have no words. It is odd that I have no words, because I usually have words.
I'm leaving out some of the other complications, like the second flood that happened at Charleston, where people were kayaking through the market downtown, and my father-in-law nearly getting arrested. It's been complicated.
Yeah. You had what is colloquially known as a really bad month.
Yeah. I do need to give shout-outs to a couple of charities, though. There are a number of charities that do nice things for families and children who are in intensive care, who are going to need surgery, that sort of thing. The March of Dimes, I think most people know about. At the first ICU we were at, where they were monitoring her and diagnosing the problem, they gave her a basket with some, you know, a nice blanket and just some other stuff so that she's not just in hospital stuff. You know, she's got something that's a little more comfortable. It just makes the parents a little rest a little easier. She doesn't know, obviously, but it's just a little nicer. And I think for older kids especially, it's nicer. And then when we got down to MUSC, Medical University of South Carolina, there's Happy Wheels, which is a play on Happy Meal. It's a Ronald McDonald House charity, which gives toys and other little things to children and families who are going through surgery and other major procedures like that at a hospital like MUSC. And then this one is specific to MUSC. There's a charity called Annabelle Baskets. There was a family who lost their daughter, Annabelle, after a long time at MUSC going through multiple operations and that sort of thing. And in memory of her, the family makes baskets for other children in the cardiology ICU and I believe other ICUs there at MUSC to just kind of give them some little comforts and nice gifts and that sort of thing. So I really want to especially give them a shout out. If you're ever looking for a charity to donate to, we'll put a link to them in the show notes. And I really recommend giving them a little something. They do a lot of work for children who really need it. They really helped us. Because it was nice to walk into the ICU one morning and see Rachel in something other than hospital white.
Yeah, I'll bet.
It was just really nice to see that. And actually, there's a ton of volunteers at MUSC, all of whom do nice things. I think the Happy Wheels volunteers also do things like meals for families staying in the hospital with their sick children and that sort of thing. I know one Wednesday they had a Wednesday night supper for everybody, which was nice. So, just wanted to specifically mention those three charities because they deserve a lot of credit, a lot of support for the things they do. I'll tell you that.
And folks, these will all be linked in our show notes right at the top.
Yeah, thanks. So how are you guys?
I'm pretty good. School has started officially for me.
Hooray, school.
Yes, I'm also getting involved in some things for the fraternity that I am somewhat involved in. They're doing Rush, so I'm sporadically attending events and meetings and things like that. I'm really busy, so I haven't been able to keep up with them. Also, if you've noticed that my voice sounds a little different, I have not gone through puberty or some kind of weird robotic transformation. The mic that I've been using for years on this headset finally decided to give up the ghost last Saturday. So now I am grateful that I have bought my webcam because it came with a built-in microphone that I'm now using.
Hooray for backups, right?
Yes. I'm sorry for the reduced quality of sound, and it's a little sad that I have to do this, but for right now, until I have funds to replace my headset, I'm going to be using my webcam microphone for recordings.
Yeah, it doesn't sound that bad.
Yeah, you sound fine. You sound a little different, but you still sound fine.
Yep. Peter, things going okay for you?
Yeah, I started school too. I've got a couple of night classes this semester. I'm taking ethical hacking right now, and I've got a computer ethics class that starts in the second half of the semester.
Nice.
Work is a little bit transitional right now. My boss just got a transfer to northern Wisconsin, which has taken her away. Oh. And she was the best supervisor that I have ever had the pleasure of working for in my entire time in the workforce. So she's going to be missed, and the transition's probably going to be a little difficult, but these things happen, you know, people move on.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, they do. Well, that's a shame.
All right, so tonight our topic is dark settings. We've got a couple of scripture verses.
Job 34, 21 through 24. For his eyes are on the ways of man, and he sees all his steps. There is no darkness nor shadow of death, where the workers of iniquity may hide themselves. For he need not further consider a man, then he should go before God in judgment. He breaks in pieces mighty men without inquiry, and sets others in their place.
And our second one is 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 9 through 13. But beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died? But when you sin against the brethren, and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat again, lest I make my brother stumble. So, I kind of wanted to bring this up, because I've got a real-life concern here. I really like Rogue Trader, and I've been wanting to run a Rogue Trader game for probably a year or so now, maybe more than that. But for those not familiar with it, Rogue Trader, it's an RPG based in the Warhammer 40K setting. And the 40K setting coined the term Grimdark. It's awful. It's a terrible, terrible place full of terrible, terrible people and terrible, terrible things.
The tagline of the Warhammer 40K setting, for those who don't know, is, in the grim darkness of the far future, there is only war.
Yeah.
And it's true, because every race in the setting that you can play hates everyone else, and even other people of their own races, and goes to war against them constantly. It's not a happy setting.
Yeah, it's a pretty nasty setting in a lot of ways. But here's the question I had for you guys. I really like Rogue Trader. And Rogue Trader has a couple of things going for it that I'll come back to. But what I'm wondering is, can I run a game in the 40K universe or any other dark setting that's true to the setting? Can I do that as a Christian? And can I do that while helping others, whether that be my players, or if I'm a player in a game like this, the other people at the table, including the GM, can I do that as a Christian and helping others in their understanding of Christ? Is that possible? Or am I setting myself up for trouble wanting to do a game like this?
I'm going to say anything you do could be setting yourself up for trouble in any setting. But I would actually say that a dark setting is actually very good for telling a tale of Christianity, because what better way to be a shining beacon of light than when surrounded by darkness? I mean, if everyone is happy and go lucky and, oh, everything's good and God provides for us all, then there's really nothing to struggle against, or there's no contrast to, well, the reason why I'm good or the reason why I'm doing these good works is because of this thing that I know or this thing that I believe in. It's like playing a minister in even a World War I campaign. You're the religious soldier in the foxhole. Everyone else has
chaplain.
Lost their faith.
The word you're looking for is chaplain.
Yes, I was thinking chaplain, but then I always just thought of maybe it's just a soldier who's just the guy who was always religious, and he signed up to serve God and country because that's what they say, and he came there and found that it's a whole lot of country and a whole less God, and he's struggling with his faith as he's doing what his country needs of him.
You're kind of talking about the Alvin York archetype.
Yeah, yeah, I think we've mentioned Alvin York before. That's a good example of someone right there, someone who retains his faith in a very, very, very unpleasant environment, namely the trenches of World War I, which were a terrible hellhole. Okay, so I'll give you that certainly anything good stands out more in a dark setting. I don't know. This is, I kind of had four questions for you guys.
Okay.
I kind of described, you know, kind of the overall question I've got, but I was able to sort of break it down into four questions about this. First of all, is it okay for Christians to play in dark settings? I mean, like, really dark settings.
And I think the answer to that is probably yes, as long as you know what you're doing and you're somewhat careful about it.
Right. And then the next question is it okay for Christians to accept the overall themes of those settings for a game? If you've got a something like 40K, where everything is, you know, distrust and a strict adherence to the imperial doctrines that are part of the Imperium of Man in 40K, the worthlessness of human life in the 40K setting, that sort of thing. Is it okay to take those themes and use them in a game and say, this is the setting as it's presented, and we're going to treat that, and we're going to use those themes in the game? Is it something where we have to change a setting like that and play against it?
I'm going
to
answer your question with another question. How are you going to use those themes in the game?
Mm-hmm. Good question.
Okay.
I think the answer to that question is the answer to the question that you're asking.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think if you're going to go around and saying, well, yes, I'm going to be the Christian soldier or religious soldier or moral soldier, whatever, it's probably not okay for that person to be going out there and reveling in the darkness of the setting or the, you know, let's say the cheapness of human life in that setting, but be the person who's going along with it, but he's looking for a better way.
Right.
It's going back to what we talked about in the video games about I became like the unlawful, even though I'm not unlawful, to win the unlawful. I became the weak to win the weak passage that we gave. And it's talking about being in the world but not of the world. It's perfectly fine for your Christian soldier character to be in that world. He should not be of that world in the sense that he should be the one who's kind of saying, yes, the imperial doctrine says this about people, but let's try to find that as the last case scenario. Let's try to find every work around to get it out there. And maybe in the end, you end up paying the price for your faith. I mean, obviously, there are tons of very interesting stories about people who were martyred for their beliefs.
Right.
And I think that there would be no greater thing than your character going, no, I will not just kill these people because this thing tells me so, when they can be saved. The one thing I'm thinking of here that I know of the 40K setting is the Imperial troopers, they get sent down to a planet to fight this evil thing, and they win. And they push back this heretic force. Mm-hmm. Or from what I understand. But then the Space Marines go, well, the battle lasted longer than an hour, so these people are obviously all infected. We're going to nuke them from orbit.
That's classic 40K right there, is we had to destroy the world in order to save it.
And while I don't think that your person should be the guy who says, oh yeah, push the button, but like be the one who objects. And maybe that objection gets him executed. Maybe it gets him thrown in the brig. Maybe it gets him astern talking to. Maybe he's able to save him.
Thrown in the brig. Heh.
Spaced.
Yeah, all of the brig is outside the ship. That should be clarified about 40K, all right?
Well, this is where I think you have to draw the line of whether you're A, the GM, or you're a player. And if you're a player, whether you're in a group of like-minded people or non-like-minded people. Because if you're in a group of like-minded people, then you might want to be able to talk to the GM and saying, yes, I understand that the setting is grim, dark, and if I deny this person, then I'm going to be spaced. But I'm really not comfortable with playing with that. It's going back to the whole thing about the make your brother not stumble. If someone is struggling with this, you shouldn't force them into, well, you have to do this, but give them the way out.
Right, and you should be a good example in that and just avoid that entirely. For those not familiar with it, this particular passage is referred to as Paul's weaker brother argument. This is commonly quoted, but one of the things that's important about it is it specifically refers to not leading specific people into sin through your actions. If your faith is strong enough to let you do something, but doing that will confuse and mislead someone whose faith is not as strong or whose understanding of Christ is not as strong, it's incumbent upon you to avoid that. But it is a specific person. This is something we actually talked about in our first episode when we were talking about our RPG's evil. You can't avoid something because a hypothetical first person somewhere might be confused or upset or misled by it. It's specific people, because ultimately it's real people that matter, not hypothetical people somewhere.
Completely. But what I wanted to finish off my little thing now that we've gone with that is, yes, if you're the GM, you have to do with what the players want, and maybe try to, you know, push for putting this in there of, hey, look, maybe there is another way. And if they go for it, great, you can do it. And if they don't want to do it, then you run the game and maybe don't run Grimdark again if your players want to just bathe in the guts. But you can massage things a little. Like, come up for a reason why the guy who is making the moral stand isn't spaced. Maybe he's a great warrior who has great convictions and they think that's an asset. And, oh, well, this is obviously he thinks of the right thing to do, you know, and he's a great fighter and he's this lord of battle. And yes, he thinks of the ways that he could win.
Or he's able to frame it in some way where the intent is clear, but he can justify it according to whatever doctrine exists or what have you.
Yes.
You actually see that with NPCs in the video games. If
mm-hmm.
There's a couple of members of the squad in Dawn of War 2 that kind of go back and forth. There's one that's really ruthless and brutal, and one of them that's actually very compassionate and merciful. But he knows, like, all of the military doctrines and stuff, like forwards, backwards, and upside down. Mm-hmm. So he can massage those to justify, you know, the stuff that he's doing that's actually more compassionate and more merciful than what the other guy wants to do.
Nice.
Yeah, you can, like, make the guy who wants to be more compassionate give him, like, almost a bardic knowledge check where he rolls and, well, you found a loophole in the doctrine.
Right.
The question, just to remind our listeners, is it okay for Christians to accept the overall themes of these dark settings for the game? I'm going to contend that the real world is probably about the darkest setting you'd ever want to come up with, especially certain parts of it in the Eastern Hemisphere or the Southern Hemisphere.
I can tell you there's certain parts of it in, you know, my hometown that are pretty awful, too.
Yeah, you know, let's go with that a little bit. Okay, so
Let's not take it places that none of us have ever visited. Let's
stay with the first world and in a relatively small city. In pretty much any given populated area, you've probably got child abuse. You've probably got at least the occasional murder. You've got people indulging in pretty much every legal vice you can think of, and probably also the illegal ones as well. You've got all kinds of exploitation, betrayal, cruelty, that sort of thing, just happening as part of normal everyday life. Unfortunately, it is part of the human condition that people are terrible to each other sometimes.
Sure, and even aside from that, there's poverty and misery everywhere just due to the situation that people find themselves
sure,
in.
Sure, and that doesn't even begin to account for things like natural disasters. One could actually say that the story that you told at the beginning of this episode would qualify as some fairly dark events. You know, new parents have difficult, you know, labor, and then all kinds of bad stuff happens at the hospital, stuff happens in the cities. I mean, it's flooding, collapsing ceilings, you know, all the medical issues.
That's true. I will say, as far as medical things requiring surgery on a newborn go, there were people there that we saw in the hospital who had far worse conditions. And, you know, to a certain degree, I don't know, does that apply? Because it's a story of hardship, but it's not an overarching thing.
But you're answering your own question. First of all, I would say the last month for you was, the theme was hardship.
Hmm, yeah.
And I think out of that, you've got all of these wonderful examples of what good and decent people do in response to hardship. You know, you've got the generosity of the charities that you talked about, the friends that you talked about, you know, the doctors and their efforts. So maybe the darkness of the situation served as a canvas for kind of the light and the hope of it to come out of.
Yeah.
Brandon kind of referenced this earlier. If you've got no problems, it's kind of hard to exhibit any kind of virtue because there's really nothing to address.
If you have no villain, there's no hero, because all then you got is a guy in a suit of armor standing around looking for someone to fight with, and that's a bully.
Well, yes and no. I think if there's no threat, you have no hero. I mean, you can certainly have heroic people in natural disaster situations. I remember after the flooding in Japan, reading a story about this guy in his, I think his 40s or 50s, who suited up in scuba gear and was rescuing people in the flooded areas just on his own. He wasn't specially trained or anything. He was just doing it.
I was being general about the if you have no villain, you have no hero.
Right, and I wanted to just modify that because I think a villain is not the only kind of threat that can make things dark.
True.
And I also think it's not the only kind of threat that can allow for things to get heroic. In some cases, a situation that's made bad by something totally impersonal, like a natural disaster, can be somewhat darker because it's so arbitrary. Mm-hmm. And I think the potential for heroism is sometimes even a little higher because you can't appeal to a hurricane's better nature.
Yeah, there is something about the whole cruelness of Mother Nature and even chance, going back to the whole thing that Grant was talking about. Is because the only thing that was running through my mind when that was happening was the phrase, do not pass go, do not collect $200, go straight to get kicked in the teeth.
Oh, it wasn't the teeth, trust me.
That Wait. Is some serious stuff that's happening.
All right, so we've addressed two of the questions. We're about halfway through your primary list here.
Yeah.
You had a couple more?
Is it okay to play characters who are part of that inherent darkness? And I think you've sort of addressed this being someone from this setting, but not really of the setting. We've talked about Warhammer 40K a lot, but there are other dark settings. Maybe most well known is perhaps the World of Darkness setting that Wife Wolf has published in various incarnations for couple of decades now.
And see, here's the thing that I think is kind of funny about White Wolf's World of Darkness setting.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the stereotype of that setting is that it's all about the study in evil, and everybody's supposed to be bad and that sort of thing. I think that's one of the easiest settings in the entire world to put heroic characters into.
Yes, it is. And I can say that as somebody who just wrapped up a World of Darkness campaign fairly recently, where I was actually playing a Catholic priest. I agree that World of Darkness, as it's written, makes it very easy to play good people who are the light in the darkness, if you will.
Yeah, the candle in the darkness, as I think that kind of campaign is called sometimes.
Right. There are other settings. Shadowrun is a tough one sometimes if you play it, I guess, I don't want to call it right.
Straight.
Shadowrun is one of those settings where there's a really big range of ways to play the setting. You can play it where it's almost slapstick, or you can play this very, very dark and gritty game where nothing you do really is right, because you have no other option.
Well, and you can play like a whole level of, you know, cinematic versus, you know, gritty realism and...
Yeah.
Well, the other thing to say about Shadowrun is it's one of the few games that literally says, by the way, racism here, all over the place.
Oh, yeah. It has all sorts of rules for racism and how to just be horrible people.
Yeah, and, like, getting back to Fear the Boot, I know a story early in their run, they talked about playing on a Shadowrun mud, where people mm-hmm. were saying, hey, we need people to be more racist and be more racist, because it's Shadowrun, and I think Shad decided to be racist, and everyone was like, oh no, you're racist. So it's like, you have to work with that a little weird, because on one hand, you have the people who are playing the setting, and getting back to basically the question you asked, we've kind of covered it with the people who are from the setting and not of the setting, but I'm saying it's also possible that you could play someone who is completely and totally involved in it and thinks that this is the right way to go, and explore that a bit, and explore the mm-hmm. the feelings and the emotions that drive that. And then one of two things can happen. Either that person changes and becomes better, or that person stays the same slash becomes worse in what they believe through the story. And I think both are not only valid and fair, but both are interesting to experience and good for a Christian or anyone to play, because it lets us see where bad things can come from so that we can better guard them in ourselves and in our personal lives. Because the one thing we have to know is that a game is a game, it'll end. But we can learn things from it and take it into our own life so we can watch things about ourselves and maybe even things about...
I'm not entirely convinced on that. I don't know how much inherent value there is in exploring the really dark parts of your own psyche in a game. I think it's probably better to stay
I'm not
the...
talking about going murder, crazy, kill wild, but what I'm talking about is exploring the motivations of what would drive a person to become that. And then understanding it so that you don't follow the same paths.
Now, I get what you're saying. I just disagree. I think there's better ways of kind of insulating against that particular set of pitfalls than exploring it. Or at least for me, I think there are. The way that my own psychology works, I have tried playing characters that were pretty bad on, I think, two occasions. And both times, it was really disturbing to me, and I felt like I needed a shower afterwards.
Right.
I think this may be a place where Brandon and I are going to have to agree to disagree, because I really see no value at all in playing a player character that's part of the Inherent Darkness unless you're already setting it up as a redemption story.
Okay, now let me turn this around on you, though. If you're the GM for a game like this, you've got a lot of NPCs who are part of that. To make the player characters stand out, to let them be the light in the darkness, the other NPCs, at least a large subset of them, are going to have to be part of that dark nature of one of these settings. Ravenloft or something like that, you've got to have a lot of people who belong in the Ravenloft setting for your player characters to stand out at all.
Yeah, certainly.
How do you do that as the GM?
As a GM, I've got a whole cast of characters, right? I've got allied NPCs whose goals and ethics generally line up, at least somewhat, with the party's. I've got adversaries that are villainous NPCs that the party is probably going to fight against or work against at some point.
Right.
And then I've got this whole supporting cast of just kind of all these ordinary people that are just there to facilitate whatever little part of the plot needs another person there. You know, the shopkeeper that they visit to buy their armor from, or, you know, the guardsman that they go to talk about, you know, the monster attack last night that happened, or, you know, whatever. These people aren't really as
right,
deep.
So you're not going as deep into their characterization, and so it's a little bit safer.
You're not waiting around inside of their head.
Right. You're kind of in the shallow end of the pool there.
How many NPCs do you think that you portray in a typical 4-hour stretch of a typical role-playing game? A dozen? Two dozen? Four dozen, maybe? I mean,
it's going to depend on the game, obviously. But yeah, there's a large number of them.
Yeah, I mean, you can switch pretty fast. I mean, it'll probably be at least 3 or 4, right? I mean, even if you've got a long stretch of a... Let's say you take up half of your session with a fight against the big bad. You're playing something really crunchy and it goes slowly, or it's, you know, this epic sprawling thing that involves a chase and...
Yeah, sure.
That sort of thing. And then you've got either the preamble or the aftermath to that, or maybe both, depending on kind of how it's set up. So, bare minimum, you're going to be dealing with 3 NPCs in a one-night session, as opposed to one player character over and over and over for the entire length of the sessions, and trying to get inside that person's head and know how to think like them and act like them.
Okay.
And...
All right, I'll buy that. So it's just the fact that you're spreading your interest thin and not investigating the character motivations and that sort of thing. I guess, you know, maybe the main antagonist you might have to do that with some, but even then it's just he's a foil for the player characters, so...
Yeah, exactly. I think also there's a purpose to whatever badness the other dark characters in that setting have. They're there ideally for the player characters to contrast with. You are setting down the canvas that they can kind of paint their story on. With a player character, it's much more analogous to acting in a long-running TV series. You know, you're portraying one character. I think when you're GMing, you're much more like the screenwriter. You're writing the dialogue and the actions and stuff for, like, everybody.
Right.
I guess the thing is, for the most part of my career, I have played characters who are good, and always good. But there was a time where I played a character who was evil, who was really evil, whose religion was kill everything, because he was a robot. Or Warforged, because we were playing D&D. The party had done some very evil things up until the point where I had joined, and my actual mission in creating this character was to provide contrast to what evil was. It's like, this is evil, and if the party is an evil party, eventually my character is going to end up kind of betraying them and kind of killing them all. But if the party kind of goes, no, wait, don't kill everything, there's good in the world, then he was going to end up dying in a heroic sacrifice and sort of a redemption story.
Right.
Thing. Okay. So it was somewhat interesting. I wasn't wallowing in why this guy was doing what he was doing, because he was a robot. The reason he was doing what he was doing is because programming said, do this.
Sure.
That's an interesting kind of non-standard take on the Warforged, too.
that is why I said that there could be some benefit in playing a character who is from that world and of the darkness, because you might be in a party where there's everyone wants to be the good guy, and if you're just all the good guy, well, you really there will be nothing that will spice up the campaign more than the guy who is going to do the bad thing, who's the hardliner, who's like, no, it says kill all orcs, so we're going to kill all orcs. You know, right. and the person who provides the counter.
Well, and pulling things back around a little bit to the question about the GM, there's a couple of paired terms that I've heard used in previous role-playing podcasts that I think would be good to kind of pull out of the GM's toolkit here, and that's the terms lines and veils. For those that aren't familiar with this particular bit of RPG terminology, a line is something that the person who's sitting there at the table does not want to come up, be addressed, appear, be referenced, anything. As far as this person is concerned, this doesn't ever show up anywhere in the story, even obliquely. So, like, if you have somebody who is the victim of some sort of child abuse and that's a trigger for them, the campaign just cannot feature child abuse.
Or even mention it.
Yeah.
You don't even want it to come up obliquely. It doesn't come up. Period.
Yeah. It's just not a theme that you can ever play with, reference, touch on. It doesn't show up in other player characters' backstories. It's written totally out of the setting. A veil is something where it's somewhat disturbing to the person, but they're okay with it being used as a plot device so long as they don't have to watch it unfold in front of them. It's the sort of thing that can happen, quote-unquote, off-screen. So this is the sort of thing where it's like... certain kinds of oppressive stuff, torture, human rights violations, that sort of thing.
The main one I would say is probably any sexual content or romance will probably happen in that veil. Two characters aren't going to sit there and describe what's going on unless you're in a very weird type of game that I don't really want to play in, personally.
Right.
Yeah, same here. Well, and it's like the players can describe their first date in a great deal of detail as they go out to dinner and have a movie and, you know, talk afterwards and that sort of thing. What happens on those player characters' wedding night, that's where the veil comes.
Right, and that's where the GM would say, and fade to black, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
And, like, for me, torture is something that happens behind the veil for me.
Same
you
here.
Know, especially when I'm running a game. I don't have a problem saying, you know, there's evident signs that this person has been tortured. Or, you know, you see the implements of it lying around. But, you know, there's no going into detail. If there's an interrogation scene, I generally don't let players start doing that. If, for some reason, some sort of physical coercion is the only option, and I can't think of a situation in which it is off the top of my head, but in that case, it would just be, okay, that happens for a while. Moving forward, we, you know, here's where he is afterwards. You know, we don't, there's no, okay, and now I'm going to use this tool to do this, and so it all kind of happens behind the veil.
These horrible noises get made and that sort of thing, yeah.
Right, no, none of that. Depending on the game, that veil may be thicker or thinner. If we're playing a deep psychological game like Don't Rest Your Head or, you know, maybe a Call of Cthulhu horror game or something like that, you may have to loosen those a little bit.
And actually, I'm going to venture that if you're trying to scare people, leaving as much as possible to their imagination is actually more effective.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Take a page from Alfred Hitchcock.
I was listening to, I cannot remember which podcast it was, but it was an actual play podcast where the GM carefully led a player into doing some of this sort of stuff as part of his descent into madness in a Call of Cthulhu game. And then sort of at the end of it, when you sort of just take a step back and look at what the, you know, and the player kind of took a look at it and was like, oh, that happened. I did that? Really? You know, you had this very real sense of horror from, wow, my character could be talked into that. Huh. You know,
oh, dear.
So, yeah, that's a little bit... That's scary because it's not just the character, it's the player behind the character who can get talked into that, and that's... wow, okay. And it had a strong emotional impact. So, again, you know, there's always a little bit of, okay, in this case, I might loosen it up. But by and large, if we're talking about a veil, line is right out of veil is this happens, but it's oblique.
Not on screen.
Yeah.
We could probably cover Lines and Veils, you know, almost in their own episode and how to deal with easily. Them and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it might not be a bad episode to do at some point. I will say that this doesn't just apply to role-playing, though. There's a favorite Christian author of mine from the past, at least, Frank Peretti, who uses this kind of thing pretty skillfully in his writing. He's written a couple of books that were pretty genuinely scary or disturbing, but he manages to keep anything particularly gruesome or horrific off screen for the most part.
Sure. Well, I mean, Hitchcock did it famously as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't qualify that as Line and Veils. I would qualify that as just not writing it. For me, like, Line and Veils, it's a discussion with people. Yeah. But then again, this is kind of off topic, and what we're talking about
it's not a perfect analog, game. No, but it's another useful example for how that can work.
Sure.
I think one of the things that's kind of interesting about some of these settings is that it's kind of like, you know, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Mm-hmm. A setting is really only as dark as you want to make it in play.
Right.
I'm going to go to video games for a little bit here. Okay, so I recently played Spec Ops The Line. That was basically the desert version of Heart of Darkness. That got pretty dark in a lot of places. For listeners that are interested in my very detailed opinions on that, I wrote a blog post on it. I can link that out of the show notes. There's no altering the darkness of that particular game. You cannot crank it down. It's already there. It's already pre-recorded. The stuff that's depicted in there is going to happen exactly the way that the people who created it wanted to depict it. Role-playing game is a little bit different. It's being created on the spot as it's being consumed, rather than being created first and consumed later. So if it starts to get too dark, you can dial it back pretty much immediately by just stopping play and saying, hey guys, can we maybe not go quite this horrid?
Mm-hmm.
You know, assuming that you are in a gaming group that's going to be receptive to that, and if you're not, you probably need a new one. You can dial it back and make it less dark in real time.
Okay. Now, here's my question for you, though. Is there a point where having to dial it back repeatedly means that basically this setting just isn't working for you? Or is this something that you need to adjust before you start the game?
I'm going to say no, and I can back it up this way. No matter how closely you try and use it, you're going to alter any role-playing setting that you use from what the original writers wrote. You just are. Okay. It's gonna change in play. You're gonna put NPCs in it that they didn't create, most likely. Events that they haven't described in the books are going to happen as part of play.
Right. If nothing else, your player characters should affect the world in some way, or you
exactly.
should just be writing a novel.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So I think dialing up or down various thematic elements in it, which may or, you know, which might make it darker or lighter or more humorous or more realistic or whatever else. That's role-playing. That's what it is. You're taking a setting, whether it was created by somebody at your gaming table or by a professional game writer or a combination of the two, and you are altering that setting by playing in it. So I don't really see a conflict there. I think that's what role-playing is.
Okay. Let me ask you something else, then.
Okay.
If you've got a setting like this, and you're just not comfortable with all of the darkness in this particular setting, you know, if there's elements of it that are just unpleasant, can you maybe play in just the shallow end of the pool, as it were?
Sure.
Things that don't get into it. I'm thinking here of, like, changelings in the World of Darkness, which...
Or mages, even.
Mages, I don't know. With Old World of Darkness, at least, taking mages up against, like, the Nefandi and that sort of thing could get pretty dark. But changelings really weren't too bad.
I don't know. Fae can get pretty dark. Have you read Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell?
No.
Well, what I'm going to say is, like, I am the champion of stealing things from other games and putting them into games I like. Like, I think I put the Harpers into Dresden Files during one of my games because I liked the concept so much. And I've gone into games where I've liked something about the system or the world, but I didn't like this other thing, and I said, well, that just doesn't happen anymore. While I can understand taking things out and making a game less dark, at a certain point, then you're not playing a dark game. If you're like, well, I want to play this dark game, but I want to take out all the stuff that makes it dark, we're not talking about playing a dark game anymore. We're talking about playing a regular game. And there's nothing wrong with playing
a regular game.
Sure. Yeah, and I'm not necessarily talking about taking stuff out. I'm talking about using parts of the canon of a setting. And obviously this does not necessarily apply if you're writing your own setting, because it is what it is at that point. But taking the parts of the setting that are not as dark and problematic, if you will, and just using those. I mentioned at the start that Rogue Trader had a couple of things that made it a little bit...
Well, Rogue Trader is basically the Firefly of Warhammer 40K, isn't it?
It kind of is. You are... 40K, you know, the Imperium of Man is this massive, overwhelming, impersonal bureaucracy that's all about war and sacrificing any number of individual people so that humanity survives. Rogue Traders and their crew are people who do not fit into this ridiculously static and unpleasant society. But they are too powerful to just kill outright or, you know, send to a mining colony or something like that. So the official Imperial answer is give them a ship, send them off, go have them explore for us. They can just do whatever they want to do on their ship. It's fine. When they come back into Imperial space, we make them act like Imperials for a little while, and then we send them back out again after having made them, you know, their, hey, congratulations, you're fabulously wealthy. Go find us another planet or more riches or whatever.
It sounds almost exactly like Firefly hacked to fit into Warhammer 40K.
I admit I only saw like 3 episodes of Firefly.
Well, the Imperium is the Alliance and the Rogue Traders are the crew of the Serenity, basically.
I'm going to get hate mail
Except
for this.
For
I'm going to get so
that...
much hate mail for this. I didn't like Firefly that much.
I have a Mikey Mason song to link in the show notes, but we're going on from here.
I'm sorry. Serenity, though, was good. I don't know what the difference was. Anyway.
You didn't watch enough of Firefly, I think. It starts
it could
a little
be.
Slow.
So, you know, Rogue Traders, there's room in the game itself to play people who are interesting and maybe who are better people than the Imperium will generally permit to exist. I would have a real hard time running, say, Dark Heresy, which is sort of the lower-level Inquisitor 40K game. It's kind of Call of Cthulhu in 40K.
One of the taglines of that is innocence proves nothing.
It's not a pleasant game, and I've read the Dark Heresy books. I can't find room to enjoy it. I can't find a way to make that enjoyable and find things that aren't all valuable or Christian about it. Rogue Trader, I can kind of make that work, maybe, but there's still a lot of darkness to the setting, and I've got players who would really embrace that. I think staying in that shallow end, like I said, where things aren't as bad, you know, I guess it's a solution.
I think, honestly, it'd be a lot more interesting when you've got a huge, sprawling setting like 40K, which covers the entire Milky Way galaxy, to play characters that wander all over the place and explore exotic planets and stuff than ones that just land on a colony and make everybody's lives miserable before they decide to blow the whole thing up and then repeat that next week. That sounds not only unpleasant, but boring.
Yes, well.
And that's like the mother of all 1-2 punches.
See, I'm going to actually disagree because I've actually ran a little bit of a campaign where the premise of it was an Inquisition. And the whole purpose I had in this game was to let my players decide what they wanted to do. You arrive on a mission, you're given a problem to deal with it. And so they go out, and we had a couple people solve it in a very direct way, a couple people tried to solve it in a very surreptitious way. The two ways didn't quite work out together, and one of them ended up ruining what the other person was doing because they punched someone in the face and dragged them through town after basically the mission said, hey, do this quietly.
Right.
And
yeah, that sounds like player characters.
Yep.
This also goes back into what you mentioned about torture, because I was playing into games and I said, okay, get information out of this guy. And I was expecting them to make some rolls, and instead the player started describing this horrific act of torture on this guy. And this is where I kind of wanted to bring up something interesting about torture, which I'll bring back, is the fact that the dude failed. He described all these different things like that, couldn't come up with any questions to ask the guy to figure out whether or not he was a cultist, because he didn't ask the guy, are you a cultist? Then they left the guy alone, and another player character who had watched all of that happen freed the guy and let him go. This was a guilty man who they had drugged through town. They didn't know he was guilty. He had some hints that he was guilty, but they let him go because this horrific torture scene horrified another member of the party and convinced him to go against the wishes of the party. And to the interrogator's credit, he said, "Look, do what you want to do. I can't decide for you."
Yep.
I think I probably would have thrown the brakes on that before it got to that point as a GM, but I also realize I'm looking at this with 20/20 hindsight.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it was dark. It had a feel and an emotion that went through all the other players, and it didn't push forward the ideas that dark was good. Mm-hmm. It pushed forward the ideas that this was not something that should have happened. That this was not something that is the way things should have been. And that was kind of one of the thoughts I had for the game, is whether or not they're going to decide if what they're doing and how they're doing is actually the right way. And I was going to push them to making that decision. Which is one of the benefits, I think, of a dark game, is that it can make people, even in their own lives, stand up and go, you know, that's wrong.
Sure.
This thing that we're seeing here, I know it's a game, but it's wrong. And it can sometimes inspire people to be better. Now, it can also inspire some people to just get their rocks off, at which point I think definitely throw the brakes on them.
Yeah, and I think you said something important there, where a game like this, if you're ever saying, you know, the darkness inherent in the setting is good, you're definitely doing it wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess you have to draw a contrast between the setting and what should be. And I know that's one of the things that happened in our Mage game, you know, we're actively working to fix the world, and it made a significant difference in it. The Necessary Evil game I'm in, which hopefully will pick back up now that I'm out of the hospital. If you read the Necessary Evil setting, it's not a pleasant place. Earth is pretty much destroyed, conquered, and enslaved, except for one city. And you can sort of insulate yourself and pretend that everything outside the city isn't happening, but it's a terrible place. There's not much humanity left. And the goal of the player characters is to fix that and to learn to be superheroes instead of supervillains along the way. As long as you maintain that, I guess a dark setting's okay? I mean, is that kind of the consensus we've reached here?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
A dark setting is okay, but we're also talking about dark games and things like that. What technically makes a game, you know?
Well, I don't know. Are we... I don't want to get into, like, a dark story. Peter was talking about Spec Ops, The Line. There's a lot of other video games. I can't think of good RPG ones because stories are so specific.
Well, I can throw out a couple of good examples from the video game world that fall into the dark story thing. Far Cry 2 gets pretty darn dark. Mm-hmm. You're basically playing this amoral mercenary who's suffering from malaria through the entire game, and it goes to some pretty unpleasant and depressing places by the time it finishes.
Mm-hmm.
Dark video games might be its own podcast at some point, but I do think there is some value to looking at some of these stories in the context that they're presented. At least the Far Cry 2 and the Spec Ops The Lines one, because they're trying to call out ugliness that exists in the real world that sometimes gets glorified in video games and kind of say, hey, this... You may want to not be quite so cavalier about this stuff.
Sure. But I mean, really, you know, a dark story like that is not particularly related to a particular setting.
No, I mean...
it can be, and it...
Both of those ostensibly take place in the real world.
Right.
Which, as we said before, is one of the darkest settings you could come up with, but...
Yeah. I kind of don't want to get into that because I'm specifically wanting to ask about a setting that is inherently dark and has all sorts of unpleasant aspects to it. We could spend a whole episode talking about dark stories.
And maybe we should at some point.
I think so. I think we should. There are games out there that are specifically all about the game itself is a dark game. The actions that you do are bad. I'm thinking specifically of the small RPG Kill Puppies for Satan, where you play just terrible people doing terrible things. I don't know if there's any value in that. I really don't think there is.
No, I don't either.
As the person who throughout this entire episode has advocated for playing dark things, I am in lockstep agreement with you that I don't think that there is much value in actually reveling in that kind of stuff.
Yeah, which makes me wonder, should I enjoy stuff like Grand Theft Auto or Saints Row as much as I do? But, you know, there we are. And Saints Row is so over the top that it's comedic.
And I think Warhammer 40K can go there too. I mean, it's so dark that it's a caricature of itself in a lot of the parts of the setting.
It is. I tried to start a Rogue Trader game a while back, and character creation just by itself turned into let's make ridiculous people. And it was good. I mean, we came up with some interesting characters, but just by virtue of the fact that they were so incredibly dark, I think all of my players instinctively made something wacky just to counteract the misery of it. Because it was so ridiculous, you couldn't help but take it to an extreme where it was funny.
Yeah, and I think black comedy probably comes into the discussion of dark stories at some point, too.
Yeah, well, that's true, too.
I think also, and I don't want to get out of the episode without addressing this, you have some objections, and I kind of do too, to some very specific setting elements of Warhammer 40K beyond just the inherent darkness of the setting.
Right.
The one thing I want to say about the Warhammer 40K setting is, as my understanding, because most of my experience with Warhammer 40K is the fact that I own an army of orcs that was somewhat given to me by my friends. And so the entire basics of its, I think, its original intent was not to be some kind of in-depth story that tells of this world, but instead it's the excuse to have all these people
fighting.
Yes,
it is.
It's the excuse for people to sit down at the table, and I push my orcs forward, and they fire their guns, and you push your Space Marines forwards, and they fire their guns, and someone falls
over. That is certainly how it started out, but at this point, the novels are probably almost as much of a revenue stream as the miniatures games are.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I've seen the price of those minis. I have seen the price that they charge for those minis.
You should see how many of the novels I receive every week, though. So,
oh, I know. Listen, my brother-in-law, he's got just about every single novel. He's got a ton of them. Now, he also had most of the figures at one point. I mean, or at least I think he did. He had
your brother-in-law has a lot of disposable income, I take it?
No, hence the problem. But he's sold off most of that, I think. For a while there, he did have some disposable income, and I think it all went to 40K stuff. But yeah, the canonical setting that they've come up with that's been expanded through the novels, various codexes and other supplements for the miniatures game and the Fantasy Flight RPGs and the video games that they've created for this setting. They've really established this very dark setting. And yes, it started off as an excuse to have little miniatures fighting each other. No question about that. But now 40K is definitely its own setting with its own stuff going on.
Yeah.
Yes.
I've never played the miniatures game, but I've definitely played some of the computer games.
Mm-hmm. I've not played the miniatures game either. I have read through a lot of the setting details. There's a good wiki that I'll make sure gets linked to in the show notes about 40K, if only because it's a genuinely well-done, fan-made wiki about the setting.
All right, but we keep kind of beating around this bush, so let's go right at this and address it.
Yeah.
The Imperium of Man uses a lot of pseudo-Christian trappings in its unit insignias and in its worship of this god emperor that's the ruler of the Imperium, and there's a lot of that sort of thing. It's kind of the Imperium is kind of the worst parts of medieval Catholicism and Stalinist Russia mashed together in a blender.
Well, and I would say also the worst parts of modern Protestant evangelism as well.
Yeah.
If you don't convert, you're right out. You are either for us or against us, and there is no middle ground whatsoever.
And suggesting that there's a middle ground is cause to be interpreted as being against us, and now we're going to shoot you.
I almost don't even want to say that because I think, you know, we as Christians can say, you know, there's no middle ground here. I mean, you're either a Christian or you're not. But I think the proper way to do it is to say just because it takes someone some time and takes time to understand Christ, that's okay. Whereas with the 40K setting, the religious bureaucracy that is the Imperium does not allow for any...
Yeah, it's turn or burn and we'll provide the fire right now. What's it going to be?
Yeah, there is no process. It's either yes or no. And that's one of the problems. It's a challenge in many ways for player characters to overcome in Rogue Trader, which is all well and good. But what bothers me about the 40K setting is that it is difficult to import a genuinely Christian mindset into the setting. Because any player character inherently, even in character creation, you almost can't have that sort of mindset to have survived this long. I mean, unless you'd secretly been a good person all this time, but I've spent my entire life carefully hiding it, you know, that's not a terribly realistic character.
Nah, I can see a pretty easy way to do it.
That might be one character. I don't
you
know about all
of the
characters.
You were from a Tau planet that got liberated, quote-unquote, by the Imperium recently and don't really fit into society and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, Tau is definitely, because the one thing I enjoyed about Tau was it was for the greater good, everything. Now, of course, the greater good was twisted and, you know, weird whenever I heard it, and but for the most part, I'm like, oh, you guys are decent.
Right. You could do that. I don't know that that works for every character, though. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so that's one of the things that puzzles me. I mean, you know, that's one way out of it, certainly. I still want to run Rogue Trader. And in fact, after this conversation that we've had about it, I feel better about running it. I think I could do it and do it better, having kind of come to grips with my problems with the settings and things I need to watch out for and ways to do it. And that's all well and good, but that still bothers me a little bit. And there's other settings that I think have that same problem. The ones that are most Earth-like, I think it's less of a problem because Christianity in and of itself still exists. World of Darkness, Shadowrun, things like that.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting if you dig into some of the lore of the old World of Darkness, there's a very strong implication that Christianity is right.
Another kind of dark game, Dresden Files, because it's, you know, modern horror fantasy stuff like that, and one of their main character concepts is Christian. Not only Christian, but here's Christian with a sword.
Was it the Knight
of
the Sword?
And it's two separate people. Knight of the Cross.
There you go.
Yeah, and we actually discussed them a little bit in our Crusaders episode.
Yes.
Yeah, there's that. And I think any horror game that you run that's set in Earth, you can have Christian characters in that, but I'm specifically talking about there are some settings, and they're mostly fantasy and science fiction settings, you know, almost by definition, where Christianity is not part of the setting, and 40K in particular, there's no room for even a Christian analog. In something like a D&D game, there's no Christianity, but there are deities in the setting that are very nearly that, and it's very easy to play a character who's essentially a Christian character. He's just calling his god something else.
Yeah, you can file the serial numbers off, basically.
Right.
With a particularly blunt file, so you can still see the serial numbers.
Yeah. It's easy to do.
And in most D&D-esque games, I don't know if any DM is going to stop you from creating your own little cultish religion, which is almost like the cult of Christ.
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely feeling better about this question in particular, specifically the Rogue Trader game that I kind of want to run, but also dark settings in general. You know, I think answered all the questions I had about that. So that's good. And hopefully that'll be helpful to everyone. And speaking of everyone else, listeners, if you've got any feedback on this episode, we would love to hear it. Please post on our Facebook page, our Google Plus page, in the comments section on the blog post for this episode. And, of course, we're on Twitter at Saving the Game. We would love to hear from you guys about any thoughts you guys have on this. So please go ahead and get in touch with us. Go to our website, savingthegamepodcast.org. We've got links to all of our social media stuff there. And I think this would be a good time to wrap this one up, because I think we've answered all of those questions. So, Brandon, Peter, thank you so much.
Sure.
You've set my mind at ease.
Always a pleasure.
Folks, thanks for listening, and we will catch you guys next time. This has been a production of Saving the Game, copyright 2012. This podcast may be redistributed under a Creative Commons non-commercial, non-derivative license, provided that credit is given to savingthegamepodcast.org. Our music is by Ryan Humphrey. For past episodes, podcast news from our hosts, or to connect with us, visit our website at savingthegamepodcast.org. God bless, and happy gaming.